For all of human history, we've been creating monsters to assign a physical form to our abstract fears. And these myths and legends we tell about our nightmares have both horrified and delighted us so much that they endure today. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Two storytellers join me this Halloween to talk about the power of fear and how we give it voice through frightening folklore. And they've promised to share some stories with us for a special Halloween treat. Joining me in this recorded interview are storyteller, author, poet, and workshop presenter, Lynn Ford. Thanks for being here, Lynn.
Thanks for having me.
And storyteller, theater artist, and Cincinnati Storytelling Festival artistic director, Paul Strickland. Glad to have you here, Paul.
Oh, it's so good to be here. Thank you.
Lynn and Paul are featured artists in the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival, November 14th through the 16th. What, Lynn, are the origins of ghost stories and scary folklore? Have they been around as long as humans have been telling stories? Do you think they might even, this desire to frighten one another might even predate language?
I think it wasn't so much to frighten one another as to try to explain something that folks didn't understand. The thing you see in the at the corner of your eye, the shadows that are darker than the darkness. And then I think it grew with some understanding into let's tell a story and which one of us can creep everybody out the worst.
What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's very correct. The explanation part of it that happened years and years ago, people would try to explain things away that they could not understand. And I think now the evolution of that in spooky tales specifically, but also in any kind of traditional folklore, it's the explanation part of it has been replaced by a wisdom. Kind of a poetic wisdom. So instead of explaining it away, now we're saying, well, this is what people used to think, and this is the wisdom that can still be derived from the way that people used to think.
Why do we keep telling each other these stories, Lynn?
When we share these stories, our brains network with one another. It's been shown in x-rays that the teller and the listener seem to have the same parts of their brains firing. There's an empathy and a connection in the stories. And it never fails. I'll tell a story and somebody else will want to tell me a story about what happened to them. So it's very much communication and connection.
Lynn, do you think there has to be a kernel of truth in a story, in a scary story, to make it truly frightening?
Oh, I think there's truth in every story, even if it's not what really happened. Yeah, we find something there.
What do you mean by that, even if it's not what really happened?
There's a story that I used to tell my cousins about a man who lived under a bridge. And I did it to freak them all out. There was no redeeming factor in the story. I just wanted to get rid of all the little cousins hanging around me. So I told them the story. I told them that there was a man who lived under the bridge and that he would get very upset if you said the wrong things or you stomped on the bridge too loud. I was kind of riffing on the story of the troll and the three billy goats Gruff. And lo and behold, as we were walking to the library together one day, there was a man under the bridge. We could see him, and everybody got very, very quiet, and they stayed together. I didn't have to herd them as I usually did as their babysitter. And when we were halfway across the bridge, a couple of the youngest ones said good morning to this gentleman, and perhaps that made his day because he really was living under the bridge.
Paul, how important do you think truth is to these stories to really make them scary, to make them resonate?
I think that the thing is, people are finding their own truth in the stories, and it is our job to create that portal, right? The thing I often say is that we're often accused of telling stories that are not true, but the fact is they're just not always factual, but they are in fact always true. And so just because you create a bridge between a magical world or in this case, a spooky world, and our world, that is a bridge that is built out of imagination, does not mean that where you got to is not a place of truth.
We're talking in this recorded interview about scary stories with two guests who will be part of the upcoming Cincinnati Storytelling Festival. Okay, Lynn, are you ready to scare our socks off? Let's hear a story from you.
Well, a very quick one that I created for a radio program, I'm going to say about 20 years ago, when there wasn't much time for a story and the story was still wanted. And I call it In the Woods. He was walking through the woods, thinking about finding his next victim, when he saw a young woman, alone, sweet-looking, pale. He walked toward her, and he put on his best smile, that grin that's kind of sleek and slightly wolfish. He figured if he could get close enough to her, if he could get her to trust him, he could walk her farther into the woods. And so he said, excuse me, I don't want to disturb you, but perhaps you can help me. It's so dark here. I could use another pair of eyes. Can you help me? Can you tell me where I am? Without hesitation, she stood. And she smiled, and with her thin, pale fingers, she reached up and removed each of her eyes from their sockets. She held them out to him. Here, she said, but they won't help. You see, where you are is lost. You are lost. She repeated, and she smiled her own smile and touched her tongue to her fangs. Yes, you're lost, and you will never find your way out of these woods.
Lynn, what makes a good scary story? What makes a good storyteller?
You have to be invested in the story. As the storyteller, you are the narrator, you are the characters, you are the setting, you are the action, and you have to bring people safely along the path of that story. I like to leave it, these kind of stories, as kind of a cliffhanger. But you have to know how to share your material effectively and take into consideration those who are listening. Are you guiding them along the path and walking with them on the path? Or are you getting too far ahead or shoving them out there on the path without the security of knowing where they might end up?
Okay, Paul, let's hear a story from you.
This is called You a Bite, Then Me a Bite. It's actually an old Kentucky folktale. Two slices of burnt black toast next to a glass full of milk on some red depression glass plate. That's all Rachel would eat. That's the only thing she would eat, and so that's what her grandmama gave her. Three times a day. Two burnt pieces of black toast next to some white milk on a depression glass bright red plate. Now, that's all she would eat three times a day, every day. And I don't know if y'all know this or not, but even a knobby-kneed, skinny 7-year-old girl, even that little girl who is scarily, scarily skinny, can be the most difficult human being, the most strong-willed human being. She wouldn't eat anything else, no matter what you gave her, and she would only eat that outside. They tried to make her eat it inside, she wouldn't have it. They tried to make her eat anything else, she wouldn't have it. So, two black burnt pieces of toast next to a glass full of white milk on that right. One day her grandma peeked out and saw where she was eating that toast. You a bite, then me a bite. you a bite, then me a bite. There was a black snake that this little girl was hand feeding. You a bite, then me. Snatch! Grandma had grabbed that snake by the tail and then grabbed it by the neck. She was still fast when she needed to be. And she looked at that snake between her finger and thumb, and she looked at her her granddaughter was holding her neck. She couldn't breathe. And Grandma looked back at that snake that she was holding between her finger and her thumb and looked back at Rachel. Rachel was couldn't breathe, so Grandma instinctively just threw the snake into the woods, and Rachel could breathe again. But she didn't speak. And she didn't eat for days and days and days. Now, I don't know if that snake died or if it just slithered too far away for the charm that it had put on that little girl. But after about 8 days, one night, Rachel came up and woke her grandma up. Grandma, I'm hungry.
Wow. Okay. Here we go. You're bringing your A games. I appreciate that. Paul, what do you think are the most important elements of a truly bone-chilling story?
I think ambiguity. The more that a listener does the work willfully of imagining the scenario based on their own palette of experiences, the more frightening that it can be for them. So it is, it's our job to create an environment that leaves enough question there that you start filling it in subconsciously so that it feels like your real world that you are experiencing. When I'm talking about Rachel Eaton from that depression plate next to a tree out back, you're seeing a different thing than I'm seeing. But hopefully you're seeing something from your childhood or from your child's childhood, and that's what's making the story even more real for you.
Lynn, do you think scary stories you tell change with the times? I read that werewolf stories, for example, became popular during World War II because the idea that just a regular human being could become a monster, like a Nazi, was so terrifying. How do world events shape what makes a story scary?
That's a good question. If we go back centuries, there were people who struggled with hirsutism. They were very, very hairy. And from the stories of them with a real condition came some of the aspects of the were creature or the werewolf. Prior to that, there were those who were supposedly cursed, and they would become other creatures. But over time, that changed and grew when we got to the stories of Bram Stoker and the wolves who were Dracula's children of the night. We had gotten into our own thoughts about how that creature would look. Would it run on all four legs as it did in the legends from hundreds of years before, or could it walk and stand like a man? And yes, if you look back over the history of war, you will see also the history of were creatures, where humans can become monsters, and those monsters need to be either destroyed or transformed back into human beings. In our times, there are some people who I think wish they could become werewolves so they could get rid of some of the troubles in the world. So you have the sparkly vampires and the good-looking werewolves, and there's a whole different side to the stories now.
Let's hear some more stories. Lynn, before we started talking, you mentioned that you have a two-sentence scary story. Is that what you said? That sounds amazing.
Yeah, those are some of my favorites. And I teach some online classes about sharing folk tales, folklore, and legends. And I've discovered more and more of what are called two-sentence stories. They're micro-narratives. So I thought perhaps I could share Oh, maybe three or four of those, if that's all right.
That sounds great.
Okay. The first one, very quickly, she asked why I was breathing so heavily. I wasn't. My sister says that Mommy killed her. Mommy says that I don't have a sister. That's kind of twisted there. You get home, tired after a long day's work and ready for a relaxing night alone. You reach for the light switch, but another hand is already there. I can't move, breathe, speak, or hear, and it's so dark all the time. If I knew it would be this lonely, I would have been cremated instead. You can find those on Reddit at times. You can find them on different websites, but these are exercises that I have my students do.
Okay, Paul, this is cruel to ask you, but I'm going to ask you to tell another story now.
Well, I'm going to go maybe a little bit of a different route, right?
Okay.
So we have we have all kinds of different ways in which we approach these spooky stories. And this is a story that I often tell to sort of open up the experience at the very beginning to make everyone feel like a spooky kind of creepy thing is also fun. So this is called The Church Bell. There's this old country church right next to a pond, and it had a bell tower, one of those big square bell towers with holes on all four sides, and that bell used to go back and forth and back and forth. But that bell ain't there anymore, because that bell is now in that pond. Now, back nearly 100 years ago, several people would get together sometimes on a Saturday for what they called a Saturday service day. They belonged to that church, and so they would clean up the church or whatever. And once a year or so, they would actually take down the bell using a big heavy rope, and they would clean the bell. Well, one day, four people were carrying the bell when one of them slipped in the mud, and that bell bung and rolled down the hill toward the pond, and it slowed down just before it got into that. Everybody saw it at the same time. Some eel-looking thing, but with legs. I mean, everybody's descriptions of it are a bit different, but it was this black, pond muck-covered, uncommon creature, and it slithered out of the pond, and it grabbed that bell with both hands, and it grabbed it by its mouth, and then it just twirled that bell down into the pond. And the thing was, that heavy rope was still attached. And this one deacon, who was this kind of person that liked to just get involved with everything, went and got his tractor. He came back, and they dragged that bell up out of the pond. And slowly, they all went around to look. And there that eel thing was, inside that bell. Maybe it was asleep. So that deacon asked everybody to back up and grabbed a rock about the size of a baseball and threw a perfect fast bong. And that thing came flying out of that bell and ran up toward the people. And some of the people ran into the church for safety. And some of the people ran home for safety. And some people just ran in whatever direction they could for safety. They didn't know which way they were going, but it felt right. And that's the three kind of people there are in this world. But when that thing ran around and everybody scattered, that was the end of Saturday work day. And the next day was Sunday. And they all came back to gather for church. And that bell had been dragged back down into that pond. So they just cut the rope and left it there. And they say it's still there to this day. I don't know for sure, because I've never actually walked down to the surface of that pond to look all the way up.
Oh my gosh. Oh, I'm so glad this is radio. Nobody could see the way I just jumped. Lynn, if you have time to grace us with one more story, I understand you have a verse for us.
I have a verse, yep, or a short story. But this is one that children have known for a long time. And it used to be in a reader when I was going to school in Appalachian, Pennsylvania, a long time ago. It's called Queen Nefertiti. Spin a coin, all fall down. Queen Nefertiti stalks through the town. Over the pavement, her feet go clack. Her legs are as tall as a chimney stack. Her fingers flicker like snakes in the air. The walls split open at her green-eyed stare. Her voice is thin as the ghosts of bees. She will crumble your bones. She will make your blood freeze. Spin around, spin a coin, all fall down. Queen Nefertiti stalks through the town.
Ooh, okay. As we've mentioned, spooky stories are going to be part of the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival. It's coming up November 14th through 16th. Paul, tell us just a little bit, very quickly, about the festival and where those spooky stories fit in.
Yeah, so the festival will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We have Thursday evening performances, Friday evening performances, and then all day Saturday long. We have a 2 o'clock at the library there in Westwood for children and families. And then we have programming that is family-friendly all weekend long. And the Spooky Story program will be probably aiming 13 and up. And that would be over in Westwood Town Hall. So the Storytelling Festival, it came about mostly because a couple of friends of mine and I were talking about how, you know, I tour around and tell stories for a living. And so many of the great storytellers that I get the opportunity to work with and see on a weekly basis don't play here in Cincinnati very often. So I just... we started this thing so that we could get people like Lynn to come in, people like Andy Offit Irwin, who is just a fantastic humorist from Georgia and a world-class whistler, by the way. And so he will be here as well. And then I'll just be filling in, telling, you know, a story or two as we go. But mostly we'll be there to sort of sit and just enjoy the genius of Lynn and Andy.
Well, I've been talking with storyteller, author, poet, and workshop presenter Lynn Ford and storyteller, theater artist, and Cincinnati Storytelling Festival artistic director Paul Strickland. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can see them perform as part of the Cincinnati Storytelling Festival, November 14th through the 16th. And you can find a link with details on our website, wvxu.org. Up next, we'll talk candy, how much we love it in the U.S., and what it does to our brains when we eat it. This is Cincinnati Edition.